This is the Popmatic Podcast. It is September, and that means it is Banned Books Week. And therefore, we're going to talk about fashion. Exactly. I'm Brian, and joining me today are...
Bill.
And Amanda, whose birthday is in September.
Ooh.
I know. Best month ever.
And Karen.
Mike.
Clint.
Clint's here. Really, I just wanted to get Karen back on the show, and I knew if we did a fashion show, Karen would come back.
She took our bait.
Come back,
I love
Karen.
It.
I'm here.
Who's not here?
Crystal, because apparently Crystal doesn't know anything about fashion, which isn't true.
I know, total liar.
Shame, Crystal, shame.
So, and on Off the Shelf, we talk about fashion a lot. So, like, you know, this podcast gets posted on the Off the Shelf blog, so why not talk about it? And then I also, in a way, I almost kind of felt like I was punking, like, Bill and Mike a little bit by doing this.
Yeah. It's about the girl's turn, let's be honest.
So I wanted to do that. Hey, I was excited about this. Just saying. So we're going to do fashion, and it is Banned Books Week, so expect some controversy. I'm going to try to make it as controversial as possible. Maybe. Try. That's all I got. Okay, Mike, you're first.
Ooh.
What you got?
Well,
fashion.
Let's see. Okay, so when this theme was like... came up, a sense of doom washed over me. It's like, oh no.
Totally punking you.
Yeah, Grady, I'm no fashion maven. Why, when I read Jurassic Park as a kid, whatever the physicist character's name, I forget, but in the movie it's played by Jeff Goldblum, only dresses in black jeans and a black t-shirt, which I thought was the coolest, like, oh. That could, but so he doesn't have to think about fashion at all.
That's I've never done that.
That's how Brian got his wardrobe.
Yeah. He was inspired. So after about 5 to 10 minutes of brainstorming about, do I know anything about fashion? I remembered a book that I saw last year downstairs called Steampunk Fashion. Ooh.
It helps it has fashion in the title for you, too.
Exactly, so. Yeah. I was like, fashion, steampunk fashion. All right. Written by Spurgeon Vaughan Ratcliffe, he of the three last names. It details many different designers ranging from professional to amateur, or amateur to professional, specializing in steampunk fashion. I seem to recall on this very podcast that the joke about steampunk is when goths discover brown was mentioned. which, you know, it isn't quite all creepy goth kids like wearing goggles, but there are plenty of them. Some of the highlights of the book for me include a designer who created in the late 18th, early 19th century, they had these like cameos where like it was just like the eye of, like, you know, of a person. So, like, if you couldn't see your loved one, you could have, like, this cameo of their eye. It's a neat idea. I saw, like, a museum piece on it. Anyway, but this designer named Brassy Steamington, created a version that, like, they look like werewolf eyes. Like, so you can, exchange bon mots with bon mots or with werewolves. There's a pub gladiator ensemble, which was like a cross between a Cockney criminal and a gladiator. It was very cool. It had this like bowler hat with this like brass face mask. It was cool with like a sword and stuff. Yeah. And let's see. A guy who goes by the name of Griffin's Egg creates gas masks that look like skulls. Cool. And and then there was this one guy who created like this armor that looked like, you know, Victorian garb that was like made of steel and like had like cameos all like inscribed in it, which was weird. But cool
cameos, like pictures,
like, yeah, like the like that ivory, like, mm-hmm. You know, but it looked like more like it was made of like marble. And then I also thought that, you know, I'd also mentioned that while researching this, I found in the Steampunk Bible, which is this really great like resource on everything steampunk related, they have a chapter on fashion, and which has a good overview about like the designers and people who apparently weirdos who dressed in Victorian garb anyway, who were like, hey, I can make a lot of money by, like, you know, creating steampunk, getting in on this trend here. I also thought it was pretty neat. There's like a debate amongst these designers. It's whether like they should create really elaborate costumes only for cons or like really like everyday wear that looks like crazy Victorian mad scientist. That was like a neat idea. Anyway. So, steam.
I think you should start rocking some of it.
Yeah, yeah.
To catalog. Yeah. Have the gladiator
goggles.
Mat. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure the goggles would help you catalog.
I need to come up with a steam sona.
There you go.
Perfectly be catalog-esque.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, it seemed like, too, like, steampunk is the one sort of SF genre that has this intrinsic fashion component that has actually caught on in the United States. Like, if you go to any, like, sort of, like, science fiction fan con, there's all these, like, steampunk cosplay. It just, like, lends itself to that.
Okay.
And I've heard, like, there's all this big debate about, like, well, how accurate should it be? Does it matter if it's accurate? Does it matter if it's geographically accurate? Like, can I put Japanese elements in my steampunk outfit as opposed to, like, usually it's like 19th century Britain is like, you know, the usually the sort of center, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that they're pulling from. But anyway.
Yeah, I saw a picture today. Susan Poulter upstairs sent me a link to Lady Vador, which is a female steampunk Darth Vader. She looks really cool. She's got like this like brass, like Princess Leia stuff on the side of the helmet. And like it glows, like the mask has this like glowing bit. It's very cool looking.
Yeah, that's the other thing is like people are like applying this like steampunk fashion aesthetic to like any character like in fiction or sci-fi. There's like steampunk this, steampunk that. So that's pretty cool.
Yesterday in the mail, I got my big fat September Vogue issue, and I think it's like 800 pages of fall fashions. And one of the designers had the entire dress, and it had row after row of eyeballs. So I thought, haha, very neat.
Cool.
Yeah, whole eyeball
dress. I totally
want to
see that. Cool. Anyway, take it away, Brian.
So, okay, so for me, I mean, I think that this kind of relates. Like, for me, you mentioned the whole just black thing. Fashion to me is just like torn clothes and safety pins and black leather and chains. That's like the only thing that fashion really means to me. And I wanted to talk about one of my favorite movies, and that was Jubilee, directed by Derek Jarman in 1978. And the premise to Jubilee is that Queen Elizabeth and John Dee, her court musician, who were actual historical personalities, they summon an angel to let them travel in time, and they go to a dystopian London future where the punks have taken over. Keep in mind, this film was shot in 1977, so, like, punk was at its height, and, like, that British UK punk where you wore a black leather jacket with
like
studs.
Billy Idol punk.
Put a safety pin through your face, right? And so in this dystopian London, the punks have taken over, and it's completely amoral, and you can do whatever you want, and it's, like, crazy, like, anarchy in the popular sense that mob rules, and, you know, and eventually, as the Queen travels around this dystopian London, she decides she kind of likes it because there really doesn't seem like there's any laws. There's no sexual mores. She can kill people. And she decides that she kind of likes it. And all the punks talk about they're free and we can write history the way that we want. But then slowly what the viewer comes to realize is that actually the punks are just being manipulated by the politicians and the big money executives at the record labels are actually just controlling the punks. But I don't know if the punks in the movie ever really come to realize that. I can't tell you about it because it'll spoil it, but it has like one of the best surprise endings ever. Like it has this really awesome ambiguous surprise ending. And what's the look? I mean, the look as far as fashion-wise, you have your typical punk fare, like, you know, black leather and spikes and pins and chains. But then it's also, like, there's a lot of plastic and, like, work clothes and duct tape. It's, like the best or worst episode of Project Runway that you've ever seen. I really like it. And then a lot of, like, 1970s UK punk fashion icons are there, like the model Jordan, Toya Wilcox, Adam Ant, Susie Sue, Wayne County or Jane County. They're all in this movie. John Dee is played by Richard O'Brien. And who's Richard O'Brien?
I was going to ask you.
Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yeah, the guy that wrote Rocky Horror Picture Show and played Riff Raff in the film version. He plays John Dee in Jubilee. It's like perfect casting. What's interesting is that in a lot of ways, the film is a celebration of punk aesthetics, but a critique of punk ideology or like the absence of punk ideology, that really punk's rebelling, but what are you rebelling against and what's your point? What are you working towards? So, of course, some of the people who were really involved with punk, like, were kind of really mad about the movie and didn't like it because it was kind of a critique of punk. So the fashion designer Vivian Westwood, who really created that look, that punk look, like, who really did that, by dressing the model Jordan who appears in the movie before the Sex Pistols broke or anything. So she hated this movie. So her response was to make a T-shirt, and on the print on the T-shirt was the letter to Derek Jarman telling him how much his movie sucked and why she didn't like it. So it's probably the first time that it was like film criticism as fashion. So I love this. So, of course, it's great now. It's like, it's called Jubilee because it was actually taking place during like Queen Elizabeth's Diamond Jubilee. And that's also like when like the Sex Pistols' God Save the Queen came out. And it was this big deal because a lot of people in the UK were celebrating the Queen. But this band, this is how it relates to the band Books Week, like this band single that was like criticizing the Queen or a send-up of the Queen was still number one in the charts, even though you weren't supposed to play it on the radio. So that's why it's called Jubilee. Even though it's this critique of all these English things, you know, and the celebration of punk, but a critique of punk, it's ironic that Vivienne Westwood's shirt actually ends up in the Victoria and Albert Museum. And I'll link, you can actually, they actually have it up on their website. You can link to it. And what's really cool is the cataloging record is there, like at least from a library dork perspective. Like you can see how they've cataloged a textile. Ooh. And it's all there. It's really cool. And then you can read the text of the shirt too, which is not, it's just, hard to read if just on the shirt itself, but the great librarians at the Victoria and Albert Museum actually have just typed up what the text says, like on the record when you see it. So I love it. And soundtrack by Brian Eno and a lot of other punk bands. What you got, Bill?
Okay. First, let me state I went on the internet and looked up the definition to fashion, and fashion is a noun, and it's a popular trend, especially in styles of dress, ornament, or behavior. Well, I found the perfect movie and the movie character. It's The Big Lebowski. And the character is Jeff Lebowski, played by the great American actor Jeff Bridges, or as he's better known as The Dude, or El Dudorino, if you're not into the whole brevity thing. Now, let me state my case. First part of the definition is a popular trend. The Big Lebowski came out in 1998, and it was not a major success when it was released. Since its original release, it has become a cult classic. We still have the DVD in our collection, so check it out. The next part of the definition is styles of dress. The Dude's is a fashion statement with his cowl neck sweater, Ray-Ban sunglasses, jelly-style sandals, and his martial arts training shoes. Oh, and by the way, check out the Big Lebowski screenplay by Joel and Ethan Coen after you've watched the DVD. Next part of the definition is ornament, which means a thing that could use to adorn something, but usually has no practical purpose. Well, that's the Dude in a nutshell. Do you realize there is an online religion called Dudeism, and its sole purpose is to spread the philosophy and lifestyle of the character? And once you finish watching the movie and reading the script, you can read The Big Lebowski, the making of the Coen Brothers film, which gives you a fly-on-the-wall perspective about the movie itself. Next part of the definition is behavior. Do you realize somewhere in this country there is a Lebowski Fest, and it started in Louisville, Kentucky, and this year it's in San Francisco, and I think there's one going to be later in New Orleans, where people come and celebrate all things Dude. Now that you've watched the DVD, read the script, and read the making of The Big Lebowski, you can now check out the book, I'm a Lebowski, You're a Lebowski, Life, The Big Lebowski, and Now What You Have by Bill Green. It features interviews with Jeff Bridges, John Goodman, and features interviews with the people who inspired the characters in the movie. And that's really all I've got to say, and all that's left to say is the Dude abides.
So I got to ask, what's the Dude wear? What's his uniform?
Why, it's the cowl neck sweater, usually a white T-shirt, some form of shorts, and the karate shoes or the jelly sandals.
I guess I was looking for the bathrobe.
I was fishing for the bathrobe.
I think we should just go bowling and...
But it's more like his whole life has now become a fashion statement, the movie. So.
Or lack thereof, a fashion statement.
Which I appreciate even more.
Yeah.
Amanda, what have you got?
Well, I think I have lived a very sheltered life because I just recently saw Flashdance like 2 weeks ago for the first time.
How is that possible?
I know, right? It's like, and I have seen Top Gun, but it took me until I was about 25 to see it. So apparently all these great films happened in the 80s and I never saw them until just recently. So I did watch Flashdance starring Jennifer Beals, and, you know, she feels like dancing and welding, and it kind of blew my mind in an enjoyable way. But the biggest thing about Flashdance that, you know, struck me, even when I was, you know, little in the 80s and hadn't seen the movie, were leg warmers. Now, Karen, did you have leg warmers?
I had leg warmers.
Brian, did you have leg warmers?
No. Oh. I was poor, though.
We didn't have a lot of money, but I had a lot. I had a beautiful set of rainbow leg warmers that I would wear all the time. And I knew this song, you know, the Maniac song where she's like running. She's a maniac, maniac. You know, so I did that dance, too, to that song, and I didn't really get it, and I was sitting there watching her do that, and I was like, oh! Like, for some reason, I had just never gotten to that point. So I have educated myself, and I do remember that leg warmers were a huge part of 80s fashion. Like, if you were a girl and didn't wear leg warmers, you were a loser. Probably because of this movie. And part of me always thought that it was because of Fame, not because of Flashdance, but I have since it. I haven't watched Fame lately, so I can't really. It could be for both, but
they're kissing cousins.
Yeah. But the thing about Flashdance that really struck me, I don't know if you guys have seen the movie Save the Last Dance with Julia Stiles, and I can't think of the guy's name that's in it, but like the storylines, I didn't realize how similar those storylines were. Like, they're really, like, Jennifer Beals wants to dance in a professional ballet company, and Julia Stiles is trying to go to Juilliard, and that's like the big difference. And actually, one's in Pittsburgh, I think, and one's in Chicago. So, ooh, big difference.
Go Pittsburgh.
Yeah. So we welded in the steel industry, and we're excited. So, yeah. So the only bad thing about the whole experience was that I could not wear my rainbow leg warmers while watching Flashdance because I don't have them anymore. So that was kind of sad. But I did enjoy the movie. And we do still have it if you would like. And we also have Fame, so you can watch it and have a leg warmer weekend should you choose to.
Not only leg warmers, but the off-the-shoulder shirts.
Oh, yeah, that the stretched sweatshirt.
And the jeans with the high heels.
Oh, yeah.
I was in, like, fifth grade sporting my high heels with my off-the-shoulder shirt because of Flashdance.
Yeah. So, Crystal isn't here, but Crystal still is a fan of the off-the-shoulder shirt. Mm. So,
it's Flashdance.
See, I was never allowed to wear the off-the-shoulder shirt because I couldn't cut the neck off because it would ruin the sweatshirt. So, see, sheltered life. I got leg warmers, but not an off-the-shoulder shirt. Maybe I should go home and cut one off right now.
It's never too late. You can wear it to work tomorrow.
There we go. Yeah. We'll have a video podcast. We can share it. Okay, Karen, so what about your fashion statement?
Okay. Well, I've got two movies to quickly mention. The first one is Frida, which came out in 2002, starring Salma Hayek. Artist Frida Kahlo was known for her love of traditional Mexican costume, and this biopic movie captures Frida's essence to a T. Second movie is A Single Man, which came out in 2009, starring Colin Firth and Julianne Moore. This film marks the directorial debut of fashion designer Tom Ford. The film's effortless elegance captures the essence of California in 1962, from the architecture to the cars to the impeccable costuming. It was also nominated for a BAFTA Best Costume Award. So those are two from my list of 12 that I made when we initially started talking about this. But I had to cut it down, which I cut down from 15 because I love fashion and movies. It's sad.
You changed it from the time we started when we got in the booth like 20 minutes ago to now. You switched up movies. You
were going to talk. I was going to talk about Dr. Zhivago.
So you're going to talk about the new version of Dr. Zhivago starring
Keira Knightley.
What were we going to say about it?
Anything about Keira Knightley? She's good. Put her in a costume and watch her go. She's just good. All right. But,
okay. So tell us about Dr. Zhivago.
Okay.
We don't have time.
2002, Keira Knightley, Masterpiece Theater remake. Russian Revolution provides the breathtaking backdrop for the story. The attention to detail in this movie is amazing. The traditional Russian embroidered designs featured on the costume are exquisite. See it today. It's worth the 4 hours of your life that you'll spend watching it.
And you said you mentioned the BAFTA. What's a BAFTA?
That's the British Academy Awards.
Awesome.
Okay. I was just going to mention that when you talked about Frida, I've done some study with Frida Kahlo, and the thing I always remember about her is her unibrow. And they said that Selma Hayek, when she actually did that movie, she shaved like her forehead so that she would try to get, and I think that it actually started growing. So I don't know if she's had to wax since then or
I would imagine
take care
so.
Of her unibrow. But and I don't know that Frida had done that on purpose or that was just her natural and that she just kind of let it go. And
I think that was her natural look and she just...
Yeah, went with it.
It,
but
yeah.
I keep trying to think of her husband's name. I can't think of his name.
Riviera?
Yes. Yeah, Riviera, yeah. He apparently liked it, so. But yeah, that was the unibrow.
Unibrow and leg warmers.
I know, right?
Get those two together. I'm thinking
Rainbow.
Jessica Biel and Frida Kahlo. Best of both worlds. Like, irresistible. Okay. So, you know, we didn't take as much time as we wanted. So I had another movie that I think I mean, kind of relates. So I want to throw it out there. And I think maybe I could plug something else, too, that relates to the podcast. So one of my other favorite movies that are right around 1980s, and we kind of went 80s with this.
We did
I didn't
go.
Know that
we're
going to go 80s yeah. with this, was Cruising. Came out in 1980, directed by William Friedkin. And it stars Al Pacino as an undercover cop that has to go into the gay leather bar scene to figure out this.
I'm already in. I've never seen this, but I'm so in.
Okay. And it's, he has to go undercover in the gay leather bar scene in like pre-AIDS New York. Oh. So it's awesome because it's like dirty, grimy, like old New York. And everybody in the movie just wears like black leather and blue jeans. Like, it's like they all have, like, all the guys in the movie have, like, this uniform. And the reason Al Pacino is picked is because he's the type that the killer is after. But also, everyone that he hangs out with, because he's trying to find the killer, is, like, looks at the same type. And one of the cool things that, like, Friedkin does is he switches up the actors. They all wear the different, like, leather and blue jeans uniform, but the same character are played by different actors. And it gets all screwed up because you don't know who the killer is. And it gets to, by the end, like, Al Pacino's motivations are completely in question, too. Because you don't know, like, well, actually you realize it's actually, at first he seems totally straight and he has a girlfriend and everything, but by the end of the movie, he's like, he goes native a little bit, right? And then it's also the
it's
idea
the
that, that, like, maybe even, like, you know, at least it calls into question, like, he himself might actually be the killer. And that's kind of a spoiler, but it's a slow burn movie. And what I just love about it is, like I said, like, hey, this is my fashion taste. So it's, like, all the clothes I like this, the whole way, the movie throughout. And then also, like, the colors are just white and black and blue the whole way through the movie. I love it. It's, like, I think it's one of his, like, Friedkin's, like, coolest-looking movies. And it's strange. I always wanted to relate this back to Banned Books Week. At the time when he was making it in 1980, it was, you know, a different time. But all of a sudden, there's this story that we're going to be about gay characters, the most famous film director in the world. Al Pacino is the most famous actor in the world at the time. And they're going to do, and the movie's going to be about, like, kinky sex and, like, murder. So, like, all these gay rights activists and these gay rights groups protested this movie intensely. They really did not want to get this movie made. They even, like, showed up on the set when they were filming and tried to, like, disrupt the production. And I think that kind of gave the movie a lukewarm reception when it came out. Now, since then, from, like, 1980 until now, if you watch it, it's like an episode of Law & Order. You know what I mean? I mean, it's an R-rated movie, but it's, like, it's just, you know, it's just this murder mystery with this kind of, like, sex element in there. So it's just funny. It's, like, and I think it has become a cult classic. Like, I know for me, it's just, like, oh, I've wanted to see this because it was, like, kind of controversial. And then it's, like, oh, this movie's great. And I was, like, no, why is it, you know, so controversial? And what's funny, too, is the gay guys who they're doing their thing, right? Or the, you know, in the movie, they come out actually okay, and the people that come out evil, creepy, gross, weird are the cops, including Al Pacino, the lead character. So maybe it was Much Ado About Nothing, but I love that movie, Cruising.
But an interesting thing that nobody's picked up on, I was listening to an audio commentary on a Val Lewton movie called The Leopard Man, and William Friedkin was doing the audio commentary, and he was talking about the unusual structure of the Leopard Man, how it would go from one story then to the next. You would go to the victim and follow that character around. Well, he's just lifted the Leopard Man structure to Cruising. It's the exact same structure. Little interesting, useless facts, but anyway.
I dig it.
Groovy.
Cruising, great punk rock soundtrack too on Cruising. Mm-hmm. But it's almost like the Germs actually recorded, I think, like a whole the whole soundtrack, but they ended up using like one Germs song on there. That's Fashion. Oh, yeah. one more thing. There's this really great Tumblr called Librarian Wardrobe, and it's like librarians pictures of their fashion sense, you know?
Oh, I have to see this.
Yeah. Well,
a lot of sweaters, I imagine.
You know? Yeah, I just... No offense to anybody on Librarian Wardrobe, but as the blog has existed for a year or two now, it's gotten more tame. It's gotten more sweaters. At first, I think it would only like profile people who were really funky and had like an original look. I think it's got more just like everyday librarian, which is cool. You want to celebrate that?
Or maybe they exhausted the supply of tattooed,
four cool dress,
pierced butt librarian.
Well, I can even remember when it first started. I told my colleagues that I was like, "We're blowing them out of the water." That's what I was thinking. So I don't know, but check out Librarian Wardrobe. Is a good time.
So we're going to talk about fashion and music?
We forgot to talk about fashion and music.
There's no fashion in music.
There's all kind of fashion in music. For one thing, think about any a punk and goth band. Just anyone.
B-52s.
There you go.
I style my fashion on them every day.
That's the only one I can think of.
What were you going to fashion and music.
Madonna. Where'd you go? Michael Jackson. Madonna.
Oh, that's good.
Both.
What do you got?
Flock of Seagulls.
Oh, David Bowie, Lady Gaga, Johnny Cash, Public
David
Enemy,
good. Yeah.
Elvis, Liberace, Bjork, Angus Young,
Elton John.
Exactly, the Beatles.
Oh yeah, haircut, good, yeah.
Maud.
New York Dolls.
I already talked about punk.
Oh, right. Roy Orbison.
Roy Orbison. Yeah. Him and Johnny Cash are
Cyndi Lauper.
Cyndi
I
Lauper.
Love Cyndi Lauper. She just wanted to have fun.
That's right. What do you
think? Crisscross.
Oh, Mac Dad'll make you.
I bet everyone here, oh yeah, we did leg warmers. No one wore their pants backwards, I bet.
I never wore my pants backwards.
No.
If we're going to talk about fashion and music, then we have to pay homage to the Michael Jackson Thriller jacket that they used to sell at H.G. Hill's department store on Charlotte Avenue in the early 80s. Anybody? Nashville native? Anyone?
No.
No, but I'm intrigued.
$40 would get you a Thriller
jacket.
The red Thriller jacket with this. Oh, but back in the day, that was really expensive, so no one could afford it. And so that's what everyone wanted.
Did you have one, Karen?
I did not have one. I couldn't afford it.
Did you have the glove?
I didn't have a glove, but I could moonwalk. And in the sixth grade, I won first place in the dance contest, dancing to Beat It.
Nice.
I did. Yeah. Beat It. To this day, started up.
Let's
and watch
do
your
it.
Dance.
Let's do it. Break it up. Let's go.
Beat it.
Yeah, beat it.
It's a good disco on that record. It's good, but it's like the best disco record ever. Saturday Night Fever.
That's a good record.
That's a good record.
I'm trying to think of fashion and music, right?
Oh,
we're still there.
I know. I think we just we're
rewind.
We're like John D. and Queen Elizabeth and Jubilee. We're going around in
time
trying out different fashions. Whoa. Except they start killing people in that movie.
Yeah, let's not do that.
That was my other banned books thing. Is like now if this movie was made nowadays, Jubilee, it would be rated NC-17. You got to watch that movie when the kids go to bed. If it was a book, it'd be banned.
What's tickling my fancy this week is the announcement that Season 4 of Downton Abbey, yes, more fashion talk, will be airing in the U.S. on PBS on Sunday, January 5th. Downton Abbey is one of England's most successful TV shows and has a global audience of 120 million. Okay, America, only 137 days to go until Season 4. Mike?
Let's see. What's tickling my fancy is that sometime in September, I believe September 17th, a video game called Grand Theft Auto 5 comes out. I am excited. Because this time around, you get to play as one of three bank robbers going on heists around a fictionalized Los Angeles called Los Santos. So I was thinking, like, you know, maybe something heisty-related stuff, but I couldn't really, like, you know, pinpoint anything. And then, what luck, on my card, I found a book called Ghost Man. Ooh. It's about this guy named Jack, tasked to find $1 million in stolen loot from a heist gone bad in Atlantic City. One of the things I really like about heist stories is that each person has like a specialty, you know, like the safecracker and the driver and stuff. And his is that he's a master of disguise, you know. So he's like the only one who like talked to the hostages, and he's the only one who like shows face to like, you know, people in the bank. So like they'll be like, it was that guy, but it turns out it wasn't him because he was wearing makeup the whole time. Then over the course of the book, he meets like a, you know, another crime lord named the Wolf, who wants the money for his own reasons. Like, you know, because it's the money like has like this pack in it that's going to explode. Not just a dye pack; it's like explosive. Like a bomb will go off. Let's see. So overall, I really liked it. I thought it was really neat, and like a kind of, you know, I get really tired of these crime novels where it's either like it's their last job and then everything goes horribly wrong, or it's their first job and it goes horribly wrong. In this case, it's the middle job where it goes pretty well. The only thing I really didn't like is that, like, it always kind of bugged me, especially in, like, the old Mission Impossible series where Martin Landau would just look at somebody and then he could mimic them in every way. And I don't really buy it in this case either, where, like, he could talk to somebody for, like, 5 minutes and then, you know, mimic their, speech patterns. Yeah, you know, it's like, I can't, this is BS to me. Anyway, so I give it 4 stars out of 5. Really cool, heisty stuff. Grand Theft Auto 5 sounds awesome. Take away, Brian.
All right, so what didn't tickle my fancy is we didn't talk about Mad Men on this show. How did we get through that? It's weird because that's like the one of the last time there was a TV show that was all about the way how people dress, right? It's like, you know, Mad Men. But okay.
There's Mad Men Barbie.
That's me being grumpy.
Grumpy Brian. Aww.
And yeah. But what is tickling my fancy, not grumpy, back to the music angle, is a new book called Assimilate, A Critical History of Industrial Music, and that's exactly what it is. It's by S. Alexander Reed, and it is so incredibly good. If you like industrial music from the early days, from Throbbing Gristle and Cabaret Voltaire and Skinny Puppy and new bands that are popular or called industrial that I don't like, go for it. It's there. It is so good. First early chapters, he talks about this division between old and new. Like, more than any other genre, there's this division in, like, quote-unquote industrial. Like, the people that really started it just totally disavow and disown, like, what is called industrial music now. He deals with that. It says it's, quote-unquote, critical, but it's not really critical, but it is detailed and in-depth, and he understands what musicians were doing on a musical level, too. The author is a musician. He can talk about what their music is like on a formal level. He can tell you which ones were knob twiddlers that didn't have anything going on at the formal level and which that did and who influenced who. And actually what is so cool about it is the discographies that he gets into are really, really obscure, these old like 80s like tape trading networks. And it was amazing. And this is, I love this. It's all on YouTube. People have loaded all these old like 1980s noise tapes onto YouTube and you can listen to them. I think as a librarian sort of raises this theoretical question, well, like, well, that is technically breaking copyright, but these are totally unavailable nowhere. You get to read this book and actually get to listen. Is it better or that they're up there, right? Also, the creepy, intensely creepy mind control ubiquitousness of Amazon. Like, so some of the tracks is like, well, I want to own this awesome track I've never heard of. So, like, you go to it, like, sure enough, if it's available on Amazon, it's right there as the first hit. You type the title. Right below it is Assimilate, A Critical History of Industrial Music by S. Alexander Reed. So Amazon knows that people are searching for this weird, obscure, like, 1980s noise song because it's in this book. Oh, it just kind of creeps me out. So it's good stuff. And Crystal, you're not allowed to get this book out and just read the chapter about Nine Inch Nails and then put it back. If you get it, you have to read the whole thing. So I'm going to say.
So strict.
Yeah.
It's named after a Skinny Puppy song. I love Skinny Puppy.
I kind of did like yesterday. That's freaky. Yeah.
All right, Bill, what's tickling your fancy?
Well, Crystal helped me, and she just told me something I would be interested in. And what she told me was that in October and November, Hard Case Crime, these are mass market paperback books, they're going to bring out the rest of the John Lang thrillers. They include The Venom Business, Drug of Choice, Odds On, Easy Go, Binary, and Scratch One. Now, I know what you're asking, who's John Lang? Well, John Lang is also known as Michael Crichton, and these were books he wrote while he was still in medical school and putting his way through medical school. So this October, November, I'm looking forward to it. They're bringing out the rest of the John Lang or his pseudonym Michael Crichton books.
I'll totally vouch. Yeah, the two that Hard Case Crime came out with previously are amazing. So, yeah I'm looking forward to this. Cool.
Yeah. Amanda?
All right. So y'all know I watch the Food Network. There's a new show that is tickling my fancy. It's called Cutthroat Kitchen. and it's on Sunday nights, hosted by Alton Brown of Iron Chef fame. And the premise is, if you watch Chopped, there are four chefs that cook. Alton gives them an entree, say, I want you to make me a grilled cheese sandwich. So they get 60 seconds to go shopping in the kitchen and get all the ingredients they want, and then they come back and put it on their station. And then they also start with $25,000 a piece. And then Alton brings up things for them to bid on. Sometimes, say, he would bring up the nasty old stale bread that you could bid on and then give it to your competitor. So they have to start with nasty old stale bread. Or I actually saw one lady, they took away all her kitchen utensils and she had to make everything out of aluminum foil. Which, like, no knives, no tongs, no pan, just aluminum foil. That's what she got. And then the judge comes out and they're, like, big-name judges, like Simon Majumdar and, you know, all these big judges that you've seen all over Food Network. And they come out, and they don't know all this went down. Like, they just know they're supposed to be judging a grilled cheese sandwich. And so, you know, and then whatever money you're left with at the end, if you bid, you know, $21,000 to not have to use aluminum foil tongs, then you get, you know, $4,000 to take home. That's your cash, that's your money. And there are three rounds. And so they, you know, they cut one each round, and then at the end they all, you know, have a big party and go home. So Cutthroat Kitchen. It is very cutthroat. It's very mean. Like, I am, it's, but it's enjoyable.
I would watch that show. That's
yeah,
fun.
It's good.
Can I promote my Movies at Maine very quickly?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Movies at Maine this month. Please come Saturday, September 14th, year 2013, at 2 p.m. at the Maine Library downtown on 615 Church Street. We're going to show this rarely seen science fiction movie called 1201. It is directed by Jack Sholder, who directed The Hidden, Nightmare on Elm Street 2, and Alone in the Dark. He was also kind enough to give us an interview, so look at that on our podcast. 1201 will be showing September 14th, 2013 at 2 p.m. at the Downtown Public Library. Thank you.
It's too bad you couldn't show 1201 at 1201.
Yeah.
Let's go around. What's your favorite banned book?
Banned book?
Yeah.
You put me on the spot. Gone with the Wind.
I knew that. That's what you're going to say, right? All right. Just said Gone with the Wind. Just put it out really fast.
Fahrenheit 451.
Good answer. You know me? Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian. Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian. Come on.
Wow. Last time I looked at this list, the one that amused me was the Bible.
I was going to ban that one because, like, we all could say that one, but okay.
To Kill a Mockingbird, Harper Lee?
Can you ban a banned book? Doesn't that bring it back in?
What do you mean?
It's already banned, but you banned the band.
Banned the band, the band.
Yeah, you banned the band, so that means it comes back in.
Yeah, you can do that.
No, fine.
I don't do math.
So I just got to. So, absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian, at least temporarily, just got pulled from a public library in Queens, New York. And a parent said that it was like 50 Shades of Grey, except for teens. Which is, that's wonderful.
I'm raising my hand. Yeah. Is it 50 Shades of Grey for teen? I mean, it's erotic, but it's based on a teen novel. I haven't read the Indian book.
I think 50 Shades of Grey might be for teens, but say that absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian by Sharman Alexie, there's like those are the same. Either like she didn't read one or the other or didn't read both.
Right? Somebody told her that and she freaked out.
Hey, do you think this has power?
Uh-oh.
Yeah, it does.
Push the on button.
And if you wanted more information, because this banned book thing is going to be at the end, you can go to
www.library.org.
This is why you're not on the podcast anymore. What happened there?
Or you can Google it. That's Bill's answer.
I'm going to contest. We're librarians, so you can come up with the best alternative search engine to Google.
I like Google.
Google works good.
Web crawler.
Web crawler's old school.
SGs.
SGs. Yes. That G's is pretty helpful, let me tell you.
For more info, you can go to Ask Jeeves and search for Nashville Public Library or type www.
The ask.com, I think.
You know what? You should Google Ask Jeeves.
www.
Be very meta.
I thought they dropped Jeeves.
They probably did.
Yeah, I think he's.
Jeeves probably got put out to pasture.
www.
Dot. Where are we going with this? Dot com.
Somebody made a mistake last time.
Oh, so we did that already.
I'm not saying a word.
I always screw this up.
And we always keep it.
Because it's the best part.
Yeah.
www.
Dot.
Library.
Dot.
Nashville.
Dot.
Org.
All right.
We did it. Yay.